We are highly dependent upon the work which has already been done in the training of the student, so that we, of necessity, need to discriminate against these kinds of things. We need to discriminate against those who are not able, those who do not have good academic and scholastic ability. We need to discriminate against those human deviants who are emotionally unstable, those who are basically dishonest, and those who are antisocial. The medical school has been accused a great deal in their attempt to discriminate against these kinds of students. And I think we have been unfairly charged sometimes with discriminating against them on the basis of race, color, or creed. And I think that there are several members of the faculty sitting in this room, Mr. Tuttle, Dean Moore, who also sit on our admissions committee, and I think that they know that at the University of Illinois, we have a policy which is eminently fair to any student, regardless of his background, with respect to those characteristics. Now, having selected the students, what is the responsibility of the faculty of the medical school? You'll note that I say faculty, not the responsibility of the school, because the school, in a sense, is a kind of an impersonal thing. And I feel very strongly that this is a personal responsibility of our faculty members in training these students. I think it's highly fortunate that there is a very real relationship between rightness and integrity. We work awfully hard in trying to train our students to have a good fundamental knowledge of the basic sciences, and trying to train them to understand the nature of the disease process, to try to train them to understand the mechanism of the drugs which we use, the advantage of the various surgical procedures which are performed on the patient. And we try to set up an ideal so that the student, insofar as he is possible, strives to be right. They make quite a fetish of getting the right diagnosis and recommending the right kind of treatment. And that, I think, is basically related to the matter of fundamental honesty and integrity. It makes not one whit of difference, I think, how well-meaning a physician is, how good his intentions are when he gets out into practice, if he is indifferent to the matter of whether his diagnosis is correct or incorrect, whether his treatment is an efficient treatment or an ineffective treatment. And I think that within that particular relationship, the medical profession has tried to work out a method of impressing it upon its students the importance of a correct diagnosis and the necessity of understanding that you must be completely honest in everything you do, otherwise you cannot arrive at a correct diagnosis. You cannot arrive at a correct diagnosis if, for example, you slur over certain diagnostic tests, or if you're too busy as we speak of it, do the sink test on the urinalysis and assume that it's a negative test. And I have seen students who have been dismissed from medical school, and quite appropriately so, because they have put down a blood count on a patient's chart that they never performed. Didn't make any difference that the blood count in that patient was normal. The important thing was that student attempted to provide information which he had no basis for providing. He was basically dishonest, and if he's dishonest at that level, he's going to be dishonest in his relationship with his patients when he gets out into practice. I feel very strongly that our students need to understand the moral urgency of this particular matter of having the right diagnosis and the right treatment. A corollary of that is that he must understand himself. He must know when he has sufficient skill to provide the best available treatment to any given patient. And when he isn't, he must need to feel free to call in those who have more skill than he has. And there, you see, is where he comes up against the matter of the economics of the situation. Frequently, if he refers a patient to a specialist, it involves an economic hardship upon himself. But the physician who is well-trained must be willing and ready to have that economic hardship imposed upon himself, because it is the welfare of the patient of which he needs to be considerate, not his own welfare. The situation which we see facing our doctors in the smaller communities who are doing general practice, I think, is related very definitely to this matter. I have talked to a great many general practitioners who have been in small communities for 3, 4, 5 years and have decided that they want to enter into a special practice of medicine, not because they weren't doing well economically. Many of them had made more money than they had thought possible in a small community. The thing that they were concerned about was the fact that they did not have the facilities to arrive at the degree of understanding of the problems of the patients with whom they had dealings that their training in medical school enabled them to make. And if the physician does not have the x-ray, the laboratory, consultation from other physicians, he frequently finds himself handicapped, and he feels that his patients are not getting the kind of care which they need and which he, in other circumstances, would be prepared to deliver. And this poses a very real moral dilemma to him. Many of them seek to arrive at a satisfactory solution by getting the community to support laboratory facilities, by making consultations available from time to time. But many of them, finding it impossible, give up and go to practice in a larger community or get special training, and then most of them go into the larger communities. And our smaller communities are being affected by that tendency. Within the medical school, we need to develop not only this attitude of being right, but we need to develop the attitude that preeminent is the welfare of the patient. One of the things, Mr. Maury, that we spend your money for up in Chicago is the provision of facilities to take care of patients so that we can set up an environment in which we constantly strive to provide ideal medical care. Now, I'm very cognizant that frequently we fall down. We fall far short of reaching that ideal. But that is the goal toward which we are shooting, that we wish to set up an environment in which ideal medical care is given to the patient so that the student can get firsthand knowledge of how the welfare of the patient can be best served. The student must be deeply impressed throughout his 4-year period with the necessity for maintaining the welfare of the patient above every other consideration. Many of you, I am sure, know Dr. Ivey, who is the vice president in charge of professional colleges on the Chicago campus. Dr. Ivey was a witness at the war crimes trial in Germany, at which Nazi physicians were tried at the end of the war for having done experiments on human subjects, frequently with the loss of life. Were being tried as having committed crimes which were contrary to the expressed ethics of their profession. The counsel for the defense posed a hypothetical question to Dr. Ivey. I understand that lawyers delight in using this hypothetical question. But they posed this hypothetical question to him. The counsel said, "Now, supposing, Dr. Ivey, you were in your laboratory and you devised a series of experiments and brought them to the stage where you needed to test them out. And supposing, furthermore, it was the kind of a problem in which if you sacrificed 3 or 4 lives, that you had a very high degree of probability that you could arrive at information which would save the lives of 20 or 30,000 other individuals. Would you be willing to do those experiments? Dr. Ivey's answer was this. He said, "No man can force me to do anything which is contrary to my moral principles. That kind of an experiment is contrary to my moral principles." We need to be very careful that we don't confuse the student. I said before that the student has a relatively slight degree of plasticity with respect to his basic emotional patterns. But I think that we can reinforce those fine emotional patterns, those fine attitudes with which he enters into medical school. We need to be careful that we don't make him cynical, that we don't disillusion him, that we don't make him regard the privacy of the patient a thing to be joked about. Many times in medical school, we pass over those things completely. And to me, they're highly important that we present a unified, coordinated attitude toward the patient so that there can be no mistaking on the part of the student what a proper attitude is toward the patient himself. Now, with respect to another problem, unfortunately, we can't duplicate in a medical school the conditions which a student will meet in his private practice with respect to the economics of the situation. But I feel very strongly that we do have a responsibility to discuss these matters with him, to give him information about the relationship of the practice of medicine to the socioeconomic problems which are facing us with such urgency at the present time. Now, one other thing that I would like to call your attention to, and that is the part that organized medicine plays with respect to these matters with which we have been dealing. I'm very cognizant that the American Medical Association has come under severe criticism for some of the things which it has done or things which it has failed to do. I should like to say, however, that I think that there are few organizations which have contributed as much to the level of the practice of medicine as the American Medical Association has. Its Council on Medical Education in Hospitals has set standards for medical schools, which have raised the quality of training immeasurably. They have set standards for hospital practice, which have eliminated a great deal of the unethical practices which frequently have taken place in hospitals. The medical association is organized into small component societies, so-called grassroots societies. Every physician is judged by his colleagues, and when a physician willfully or repeatedly violates the code of medical ethics, the physicians know how to deal with that physician. Dr. Birch, who is a professor of medicine in our school, came back from a trip to Africa with a native proverb, which I think is very appropriate. The proverb goes like this: "A turtle knows where to bite another turtle." And I think that physicians know how to deal with physicians. Now, I don't know anything that I can say to sum this all up, except to say that we do recognize a very real responsibility for training our young physicians in such a way that they will go out not only with a good deal of technical knowledge and skill, knowledge of the basic mechanisms of the human body, but that they go out understanding their relationship to their fellow man and with a firm resolve to practice medicine in accordance with the highest standards that man can set. Thank you very much.